SS-Hauptsturmführer Franz Stangl was a man who was waiting to be exposed. It seemed almost inevitable, as he had the blood of 800,000 Jews on his hands. Between August 1942 and August 1943, Stangl had been the commandant of Treblinka death camp in Poland. Stangl bore command responsibility for the deaths that had occurred whilst he had been running Treblinka. Previously, Stangl had commanded the Sobibor extermination camp, where another 100,000 Jews had perished during his period in command. By the summer of 1945, Stangl, in common with many other Nazis, had taken refuge in the Austrian Alps, among the last area overrun by the advancing Allies. The small, pretty villages were crammed with former SS men, all of whom were hoping against hope that they might avoid arrest as the US Army moved into the vacuum created by the German surrender. Within days, American patrols were sweeping the valleys in their search for high-ranking Nazi war crime suspects. Stangl, who was 37 years old at the time, was hiding in the home of an Austrian policeman and family friend in the village of Altosee. Also in Altosee, the same time, was SS-Obersturmbannführer Adolf Eichmann, Reinhard Heydrich's deputy until his assassination in 1942, and the man who was directly responsible for implementing the final solution. Eichmann was the archetypal Nazi bureaucrat, a slight, balding and physically rather unimpressive man, but a man born to follow orders and a fervent National Socialist. When the Germans had taken over Hungary in 1944, it was Eichmann who had personally issued the orders to ship 400,000 Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz-Birkenau. Alongside Stangl and Eichmann in Altosee was a veritable who's who of wanted Nazi war criminals, including Heydrich's successor, the Reich Main Security Office and Eichmann's boss, the monstrously tall, scar-faced Austrian giant, Dr. Ernst Kaltenbrunner. The other Nazis asked Eichmann to leave, believing him to be the greatest prize for the searching Allies, one SS officer describing Eichmann as the personification of all the crimes they had jointly committed. Leaving his wife, Vera, and their three sons in his uncle's villa in the village, Eichmann, who was armed with a machine pistol, headed up into the mountains with a small group of fellow SS officers, where they intended to fight it out with the Americans rather than be captured. They lived initially in a quiet, secluded inn, but then moved into an even more remote valley. There, the other SS decided to cut Eichmann loose, and with only his adjutant, Obersturmführer Rudolf Jenisch, for company, Eichmann headed north. They sensibly discarded their SS uniforms and disguised themselves as a pair of Luftwaffe NCOs for the journey. If Adolf Eichmann's name had appeared on the order that had condemned millions to a cruel death, Franz Stangl bore the responsibility of having operated the death factories of the final solution. He had originally been a police officer before joining the SS. In 1940, on the direct orders of Himmler, Stangl had become the superintendent of the T4 euthanasia program that was based at Schloss Hartheim in Austria. This was the bloody prelude to the mass murders that were to follow. The mentally retarded and physically disabled were murdered at the Hartheim institution on the recommendations of doctors as the Nazis attempted to remove all, quote, defectives, unquote, from their population. Initially hesitant of associating himself with the murder program, Stangl had been soothed by reassurances from his superiors, and somewhat surprisingly from Roman Catholic priests and nuns, who themselves had recommended that some of their own parishioners be put to death. Over 70,000 patients were to die over the course of the T4 program, which continued in operation until just after the war ended in 1945. Told that the killings were the responsibility of doctors, Stangl had set aside his moral reservations and done his duty as he conceived of it. No fanatic, Stangl always maintained that he was merely a policeman doing his job, writes Guy Walters in Hunting Evil. If anybody embodied the banality of evil, it was Stangl. From the gloomy Schloss Hartheim, Stangl had progressed to a crucial role in Operation Reinhard, the Nazi plan to rid Poland of its Jews once and for all. Franz Stangl was soon arrested by an American patrol. He suspected that his police officer host had betrayed him to the Americans, and he was taken to a prison at Bad Ischl. Under a standard American interrogation, Stangl admitted that he had been an SS officer, but he did not mention either the T-4 program or his involvement in Operation Reinhard. Instead, he told the Americans that he had been employed on anti-partisan duties in Italy and Yugoslavia. And he was convincing enough that his interrogators believed him. Stangl had served in the region after the conclusion of Reinhard, so he was able to speak from experience. The Americans believed Stangl to be harmless, and they transferred him to Glasenbach prisoner of war camp just south of Salzburg in July 1945. At Glasenbach, Stangl became just another prisoner among 20,000 former German servicemen. Conditions were rough and ready inside the camp, but he was able to see his wife, and after a few months, the living conditions began to improve, along with the food. Adolf Eichmann remained on the loose while Stangl cooled his heels in a prison camp. Eichmann and his adjutant Jenisch headed to Salzburg. From there they continued north into Germany. After several close shaves, Eichmann was eventually captured after an American patrol found his blood group tattooed under his left arm, as had been the SS requirement. When confronted with this evidence, Eichmann admitted that he was a cavalry officer by the name of SS-Untersturmführer Otto Eckmann. He carefully chose the name Eichmann because of its similarity to his real name, so that if anyone recognized him in a camp and called him by his real name, the Americans probably would not catch on. Eichmann was processed through several prison camps, fearing all the while that he would be exposed. Things began to become uncomfortable for him in January 1946, when barely 30 miles away from his camp, the Nuremberg trials were in full swing. His name was repeated over and over during the cross-questioning of one of his former subordinates, SS-Hauptsturmführer Dieter Witzlitzeny, who was determined to save his own neck by fully cooperating with the tribunal. Eichmann's role as the administrator of the Holocaust was revealed in full to the court. Eichmann soon discovered what had been said as news spread fast among the POWs, and in fear he revealed his true identity to several SS officers in the camp. Although Eichmann was about as popular as a dose of the plague, the SS officers agreed to help him, and on the 5th of February 1946, Eichmann escaped from the camp carrying forged papers in the name of Otto Henninger. Eichmann immediately headed 200 miles south to the Bavarian town of Prien, where he hid out in the sister's house of an SS sergeant that he had been imprisoned with. At the time, Eichmann was only 5 miles away from another major war criminal, Dr. Josef Mengele, who was working as a farm labourer in the village of Mangolding. The number of US Army patrols in the area soon convinced Eichmann that it was time to move on, and he found work through SS contacts as a forester in the village of Eversen, close to Hamburg in northern Germany. Eichmann would stay out of sight in Eversen for the next 3 years, biding his time until he could flee the country. Franz Stangl sat it out at Glasenbach POW camp until the summer of 1947, when the Austrians began to investigate the T4 euthanasia program. It was only a matter of time before Stangl's name came up, and he was moved to a prison in Linz to await trial. The Austrians made the mistake of transferring Stangl to an open prison, but they knew nothing at that stage of his involvement in Operation Reinhard. At the open prison, Stangl even enjoyed conjugal visits from his wife. It was his wife, Theresa, who persuaded Stangl to escape from Linz after a driver from Schloss Hartheim was given a 4-year prison sentence for his minor part in the euthanasia program. Obviously, Stangl, as the former superintendent, would be locked away for a considerable amount of time. On the 30th of May 1948, Stangl, in company with another prisoner named Hans Steiner, escaped from Linz. Therese Stangl had given her husband some cash and jewellery, and Stangl had collected together some canned goods for the journey. Their first destination was the city of Graz, 130 miles to the west. The two men walked all of the way to Graz to save money. Another war criminal and former camp commandant who had headed for Graz was Eduard Roschmann, who had been appointed the commandant of the Riga ghetto in Latvia in January 1943. It was a dangerous city for a Nazi fugitive to visit, and the British were laying in wait for Roschmann. Roschmann came from a good family, the son of a brewery manager in the Austrian city of Graz. Born in 1908, Roschmann was too young to serve in the First World War, but his attraction to uniforms and military discipline was served by his joining a section of the Austrian Home Guard in 1927 that was called the Fatherland's Front. After university, where the young Roschmann had trained as a lawyer, he had worked in a brewery, gravitating next to the civil service in 1935. Following the German Anschluss, or takeover of Austria, in 1938, Roschmann had joined the Nazi Party, which had been up to that time an illegal organization. The following year, Roschmann had donned the uniform of the SS for the first time. And by the time war was being contemplated against the Soviet Union, Roschmann was working for Reinhard Heydrich's RSHA, the office that oversaw all of the security organs of the Nazi state. Roschmann, the bureaucrat, was serving in the Sicherheitspolizei, or security police, when he was assigned in January 1941 to the Sicherheitsdienst, the dreaded SD. From there, he joined SD Department 4, the Gestapo, and was placed under the command of the security police and SD in occupied Latvia. The Jewish population of Latvia was almost entirely eliminated in one of the worst mass executions in history, and Roschmann played his part in the murders. A large ghetto had been created in Riga by the Germans, and basically a section of the city had been segregated by barbed wire fences and armed guards, and the nation's Jews crammed into the resulting camp. On the 30th of November, and again on the 8th of December 1941, the Nazis had emptied most of the Jews out of the large ghetto and forced marched them out of the city to the nearby forest of Rumbala. There they were shot in large groups, 24,000 men, women and children being put to death. It was, after the Baba Yar massacre on the Eastern Front, the second largest mass shooting conducted by German forces during the Second World War. Only a few thousand Latvian Jews were spared. The SD then created three ghettos in Riga. The first was the men's ghetto. The second housed 500 female Jews and was called the women's ghetto. The last was much larger and was filled with German, Austrian and Czech Jews who were shipped to Riga on cattle trains. This area was known as the German ghetto. In March 1942, there was another mass shooting action in which Roschmann was involved, not as a murderer, but as an administrator, whose job was to select likely victims from the population of the German ghetto. Those selected were merged with a group of Jews from the Jungfernhof concentration camp outside Riga. In a typically cynical Nazi gesture, the condemned were led to believe that they were being taken to a better camp with improved conditions, a mythical place known as Dunamunda. In reality, 3,740 German, Austrian and Czech elderly, sick and children were transported to the forest north of Riga and shot. In January 1943, Roschmann was appointed ghetto commandant. Later he was given the sobriquet the Butcher of Riga by his victims. But he was not a man prone to executing people on the spot for minor offences, as had the previous ghetto commandant, Kurt Krauser. Roschmann did order the summary executions of several hundred young male Jews in the aftermath of an investigation into a burgeoning resistance plot among the ghetto prisoners, and he was also implicated in several individual murders as well. Later transferred to the Lenta work camp, Rochman dispatched many prisoners to the Riga Central Prison, where they were murdered, and considerably tightened up the regime at Lenta, which the previous commandant had kept relatively lax, as he had personally profited from the skills of the Jewish artisans and craftsmen that were imprisoned there. In autumn 1943, Rochman was placed in charge of Kommando Stützpunkt, a work detail of Jewish prisoners that was tasked with the grim business of exhuming the thousands of bodies of the people the Nazis had already shot in the forests around Riga, and then burning them to cover up traces of the crimes that had been committed. Every 2 weeks, the entire Jewish work detail was shot and replaced with fresh prisoners. Rochman's murderous activities came to an abrupt end in October 1944 when the Red Army broke through on the Eastern Front and rapidly advanced into the Baltic states. The only way out was by sea to Danzig, and the SS quickly shut down the concentration camps and ghettos, in some cases evacuating the prisoners along with themselves. After the German surrender in May 1945, Rochman headed back to his hometown of Graz, in the British zone of occupation in Austria. As a former German soldier, Rochman was soon picked up by the British military police. He was arrested and taken to an internment camp for processing as a former German soldier. Rochman realized that he had to conceal his identity, and he managed to disguise himself as an ordinary member of the German armed forces. The sheer volume of prisoners meant that the British could not intimately examine each inmate, and Rochman was released from custody without further interrogation. However, in the meantime, Allied war crimes investigators had identified Eduard Rochman for immediate arrest over his murderous activities in the Riga ghetto, and they placed his wife under surveillance in Graz, hoping that Rochman would reveal himself. This he duly did in 1947, and he was immediately arrested by the British when he knocked on his front door. This time, sure of his identity, the British sent Rochman to Dachau, the notorious former concentration camp that was being used by the Allies as a holding centre for accused Nazi war criminals. Unfortunately, as with so many other Nazis discussed in this programme, Rochman was able to escape from custody in 1948 and go on the run. He left Germany and headed south into Italy, as so many other Nazi fugitives were to do, eventually having heard about the rat lines out of Europe that were being operated by several individuals and groups, including the Vatican. Franz Stangl avoided arrest in Graz, managing to sell the jewellery that his wife had given to him. Whilst in Graz, Stangl ran into an old Operation Reinhard colleague from his days at Sobibor, SS Oberscharführer Gustav Wagner, who had been deputy commandant at Sobibor when around 200,000 Jews had been killed. Wagner was penniless, and he begged Stangl to take him with him. Stangl and Steiner were joined by Wagner for the most challenging aspect of their escape, crossing over the Alps into Italy. The three men aimed to get to Rome, where it was rumoured that a German bishop named Alois Hüdal was using his Vatican connections to help Nazi fugitives escape from Europe. The three SS men travelled 250 miles west to Murano in the Italian Tyrol, traversing the Alps. The journey was terrible, and it was only Stangl's mountaineering experience that enabled them to survive a dangerous traverse on foot of some of the bleakest and wearying terrain in Europe. Stangl ventured alone into the smart Italian tourist town of Murano to try and make contact with Bishop Hudal's representatives, but he was arrested by the police as he looked like a vagrant after the punishing mountain journey. However, Stangl was able to talk his way out of the local police station after giving the carabinieri a story about how he had travelled south seeking work to support his wife and children back in Austria. And in the summer of 1948, Stangl and Wagner arrived safely in Rome. Steiner decided to return to Austria, where he gave himself up to the Americans. Rome at the time was teeming with Nazi fugitives, all of whom were being assisted to new lives outside of Europe by the various Roman Catholic groups that had set up rat lines to freedom. Perhaps the most infamous fugitive to pass down an Italian rat line was Dr. Josef Mengele, the former chief doctor of the women's camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau. SS-Hauptsturmführer Mengele's escape from justice was legendary. In 1943, the 32-year-old Mengele had gained a notorious reputation at Auschwitz, where he had conducted medical experiments on inmates in a series of pseudo-scientific racial studies. He was particularly interested in twins, and used his time on selection duties at the railhead, where he, along with other SS doctors, decided which prisoners would live and which would be sent immediately to their deaths, to pick out twin children. Mengele had come to Auschwitz from frontline combat service as a medical officer with the 5th SS Panzer Division Viking on the Eastern Front, where his bravery in battle had been recognized with the award of the Iron Cross 1st and 2nd Class. A suave and charming man, whose homicidal instincts were normally carefully concealed, Mengele wore his military decorations with pride, and they set him apart from most of his colleagues, who were mostly career concentration camp personnel. Mengele had been badly wounded on the Eastern Front, and was assigned to Auschwitz because he was no longer fit for frontline service. Surviving prisoners recalled Dr. Mengele standing at the railhead, whistling classical music and calmly directing people to their deaths with a smile. Jewish doctors, who he forced to collaborate with him in his experiments, recalled his sudden rages. He would play with the child patients in his clinic, bring them presents, and make a fuss of them. But once they were required for his experiments, Mengele would kill them without any qualms. Some 3,000 sets of twins passed through Mengele's hands during the war, and only 100 sets survived the war. By early January 1945, the Red Army was rapidly advancing through Poland, so the SS destroyed the crematoria at Auschwitz-Birkenau and evacuated those prisoners who were still able to walk towards the Reich. Mengele left with extensive research notes from his work on the 27th of January. He transferred to Gorsleben camp in Lower Silesia, where he worked as a camp doctor, and when this camp was also dissolved at the end of February 1945, Mengele worked in some other concentration camps for short periods, before joining a retreating regular army medical unit on the 2nd of May, whose intention was to surrender to the Americans. When Mengele was taken prisoner by the US Army, he did not initially conceal his identity, but such was the confusion at the time that his significance as a war criminal was unfortunately overlooked. He was released in June 1945 in possession of papers giving his name as Fritz Hollmann. From July 1945 to May 1948, Mengele, one of the most wanted Nazi fugitives, worked as a simple labourer on a farm in Bavaria. He remained in close contact with his wife and son, and with the help of an old family friend, his escape from Europe was arranged. Mengele's destination was Argentina, and he travelled, with possible assistance from the shadowy Odessa organisation via Innsbruck, Sterzing, Merano and Genoa, where he boarded a ship to freedom. In 1950, Mengele's former boss, Adolf Eichmann, went to Italy, posing as a German refugee named Riccardo Clement, finally leaving his bolt hole in northern Germany. In Italy, he was assisted by a Franciscan friar who worked for Bishop Alois Hudal of the Vatican Rat Line escape route, who handed him a Red Cross passport and an Argentinian visa in the name of Clement. With these documents, it was relatively straightforward for Eichmann to book passage on a ship to South America. On the 14th of July 1950, Eichmann did just that. And for the next 10 years, he effectively disappeared below the radar of Western intelligence services and Nazi hunters, leading an unassuming life with a series of nondescript jobs. The ease with which so many important Nazi war crime suspects fled Europe in the years after the Second World War is astounding. But when the limited extent of Allied investigation teams is considered, particularly those created by the British, it is understandable how fortune favoured evil men. But what is a particularly interesting aspect of the story of the Nazi fugitives' flight from Europe is the generous assistance that was afforded to many of them by several different groups, prominent being among them the Roman Catholic Church. Bishops, priests, monks and nuns all actively assisted some of the worst mass murderers in history to flee from justice, using their Vatican protection and money to organize a well-managed series of escape routes with destinations located all over the developing world. These were the infamous and appropriately named Ratlines.